This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. In this day of No Child Left Behind, schools are under increasing pressure to produce standardized test results. Given the other challenges schools are facing, like growing poverty and violence, questions about how schools are run and how students learn are hotly contested issues. But at the top of the list is simple safety. For a student to learn, he or she cannot be afraid. In a series of articles written in June, the Charlotte Observer explored the issue of school discipline. Reporters found that the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools have a suspension rate twice that of the national average, and that the trend spreads across the state of North Carolina. Does the rise in suspensions signal a new discipline philosophy? Are school suspensions the best way to reverse disruptive behavior? And how else can overburdened schools keep classrooms safe? We're exploring the topic this hour and invite your phone calls at 877-962-9862. And we're going to begin the conversation with Liz Chandler, one of the reporters who worked on the series for the Charlotte Observer. Liz, welcome to the program.
Hi, Frank. Pleased to be here.
You worked on this series for the Observer. What sparked the series?
Well, Charlotte is going through quite a transition in the demographic changes. We've had new school assignment plans that pack together most of the children in poverty in the same schools, and our high schools are performing pretty poorly, and so we have a great debate in the city going on about really how to discipline children and be sure that these classroom environments are as productive and quiet for children to learn, good learning environments. So as that debate has gone on, we decided we needed to sort of get to the bottom of what is actually happening in the classrooms, what sort of discipline issues are there, and we went ahead and looked at suspension data, and we also looked at police reports and arrest reports in the city to sort of get a handle on what's actually happening in the classrooms, and it was quite interesting. I'll start with suspensions. Basically, we found that 1 in 6 children in the Charlotte schools were suspended, and it led to it's led to quite a debate about whether this is something that's actually helping children when they're thrown out of school, and often kids will come back perhaps even more angry and farther behind.
Well,
and it sort of appears to be not producing the results the school system wants.
Well, let's start with the figure. 1 in 6, is that an increase? It sounds, I mean, that's an astounding figure, it seems to me. Has that changed, and over what period of time? How fast arises that?
It's been increasingly growing. As the zero tolerance policies have swept the country, I think many school systems are seeing this. I think many school systems are much quicker to suspend children and just get them out of the classroom and not deal with whatever is driving their behavior issues. So, we were surprised, and that was one in six kids actually kicked out of school. And you know, of course, when they're out of school, they're not learning their lessons, and they may be, in fact, in neighborhoods where they're learning negative things.
Sure.
We'll deal with later.
Well, one of your other findings too was that black students are almost 4 times more likely to be suspended than whites.
Yes, the racial disparities exist across the state. It's as well as the nation. It's an issue that I think the country has just a long way to go to figure out. It's really a complex issue. It's hard to say what causes that. Some people will want to tell you, well, the black children that we have are not meeting or acting the way we expect them to. Other people would say there's racism involved with who gets disciplined. Some of it comes down to cultural understandings. You know, you have mostly middle class white teachers, and if you have children from impoverished or maybe a black type culture, there may be some misunderstandings with what's going on in the behaviors.
Yep.
and that can result in bad discipline issues.
Why are the kids getting kicked out? Is it for violence? Can it be less than a violent act that can get you suspended?
Charlotte has about 32 reasons they'll suspend you from school, including very minor things like attendance issues, skipping class, tardiness, that type of thing.
you can get thrown out of school for skipping class?
Yeah.
That doesn't seem right somehow.
Sort of a misnomer
think
there,
that
but,
through.
We did find that about three-quarters of suspensions were for nonviolent acts. I mean, I don't think anybody in this debate thinks that if a kid does something, you know, aggressive towards somebody else, they would probably think suspension is appropriate. But three-quarters of them were really involved things other than threats to other students or violence against them or that type of thing. So there really is some opportunity to lessen the number of suspensions, I think, if they focus on that big pot of things that involve something other than violence.
The other thing striking about your series is the number of young children, kids as young as 5, 7 years old, are being suspended.
Yes, that was surprising to us, too. You know, I guess some of the administrators would tell you that, you know, that if a kid kicks you or something, they have to kick them out of class or out of school. I do think that the national experts will tell you there should be other types of interventions, perhaps better, more aggressive in-school suspension programs, counseling, that type of thing, especially at those younger ages. That's just a time when kids are so vulnerable educationally.
Are the schools troubled by these figures, and are they looking at alternatives to suspension to handle the discipline problems?
You know, I think they are. I think we were surprised to find out, to see really how little they knew about what they were doing. They really just keep data sort of at a school level, and nobody had really ever pulled together a system-wide look. And compared schools and compared racial rates and that type of thing. And I think when we came back to them with numbers, they were actually a good bit surprised, and they created a task force to sort of look into this. Now, you know, it remains to be seen what they'll do about it. I know there's a report due in August where they will consider some other options or talk about ways to improve things. They do have some pilot programs going on. There's some positive behavior programs that sort of come from a national model that a few schools are using. They also have opened one suspension center so far, where if you're kicked out of school, you go to this place and you're in a structured environment and hopefully not just on the street.
Yeah, Liz, thanks very much.
Sure.
Liz Chandler is a reporter for the Charlotte Observer. So what is necessary to ensure order and discipline in North Carolina schools, and to what extent should schools be responsible for educating students who are under suspension? Here to explore some of those issues are Sharia Reed. She's Director of Education at the North Carolina Justice and Community Development Center. She's working with legislators to make sure that suspended students do receive an education. Sharia, welcome.
Thank you.
Marvin Pittman's with us as well, State Director of Middle School Education for the Department of Public Education, Public Instruction, rather. Marvin, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Sharia, let me start with you. You're working to make sure suspended students don't miss out. Tell us about some legislation that's proposed by Representative Jean Preston.
Yes, there is current legislation to educate students as an alternative to just suspending students. I think everybody agrees that this is important. Disagreement comes with the details of how to do this. What the legislation proposes is that every school system have a program for educating students who have been suspended, whether short-term or long-term suspension, and that the goal be to get these students ready to come back to school whenever their suspension ends. In other words, they should be returned to school and be able to resume their education. Unfortunately, it's met some opposition from various groups. I think a lot of the opposition comes from a valid concern of how are we going to pay for this. For the school systems, they're very concerned with, you're asking us to do this and you're not really giving us any additional money. And our position is we should give the school systems whatever money they think they need in order to do this. If that's the holdup, then we need to find funding.
And before I want to pursue, obviously, the alternatives and how you might handle the situation. But Marvin Pittman, first let me ask you if there are state regulations or standards about suspending a student, or is it up to the schools?
That's pretty much a local determination. Local boards of education set their own policies regarding behaviors that would endanger a student to be suspended.
Do you think the state ought to regulate this, or should it still be left to the schools?
I do believe that that's a local determination. Certainly there are some offenses that the state does say would require a student to be long-term suspended, possession of weapons and those kinds of things. But pretty much, I believe, and the state Board of Education believes, that those are the kinds of decisions that are made in the local school system. It's also important to understand that in North Carolina, we are a public education state that says schools have local control over many issues. And we would certainly work with various school districts if they have issues of concern regarding these kinds of behaviors. But it is a local decision by the local Board of Education.
Well, Sherry, briefly, when you hear that the Charlotte school system is suspending 1 in 6 kids and 2/3 of those are for not for violent offenses, do you think the number of suspensions would go down if schools were forced to have programs in the school, however costly they might be?
I think that, the bill isn't really about dealing with kids before they're suspended. It's about dealing with them afterwards. Mm-hmm. To deal with the students before they're suspended, I do believe that there needs to be a focus on intervention, on counseling for students. The analogy I use is that, at home, if a child is disrespectful to his or her parent, the parent doesn't say, go to the neighbor's house for 3 days because, mm-hmm. You've been suspended from my home. The school has to do the same sort of thing. It's like you deal with the problem rather than saying, as the reporter mentioned, 2/3 of these students are being suspended for nonviolent offenses. Yeah. So maybe we should not be suspending the students.
You're listening to The State of Things Today, talking about discipline in North Carolina schools with Sheria Reed, Director of Education and Law at the Law Project of North Carolina Justice Center. Marvin Pittman is Director of Middle School Education at the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. Your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking today about discipline in North Carolina schools. With us is Sheria Reed, Director of the Education and Law Project of the North Carolina Justice Center, and Marvin Pittman is Director of Middle School Education at the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. And we're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Sheria, what do you think is the effect on kids who are suspended? I mean, does this sort of shake them up and now they see, you got to straighten up, fly right?
No, the research pretty much confirms that suspension doesn't have a rehabilitative effect on students. It's kind of like our prison system. We lock people up, but we don't really, it doesn't rehabilitate them. And the fear of suspension is not enough to stop most students from doing the things that get them suspended. They're kids, and they always believe that they won't be the ones to get caught. And there's some side effects to suspension that are even worse than the suspension itself. Students who've been suspended are more likely to drop out of school. So, one study that was done in the 1980s suggested that 30% of the students who drop out of school were students who had three or more suspensions because they just don't come back. They don't have a relationship with the school. They feel alienated and they don't come back.
But Marvin Pittman, I'm guessing there is certainly a safety consideration here for the other students, those who are not suspended, and that does play a part in the decision to suspend.
That certainly does, because one of the things, if you interview parents and you ask them what do they consider most important about schools, you would think that they would say academic performance of the students, but that is not. Typically, the response is, and research bears this out, is that parents want to make sure that their schools are safe and that their individual child is safe. So certainly schools do have a responsibility to assure safety of the school. But let me just back up for a minute and commend Liz and both Sheria on some things that they've said. This is an issue that is not just a school issue, Frank. It is very involved. It's very comprehensive. And schools can't solve it by themselves. It's going to take the entire community working toward helping us to resolve some of these issues. And behavior really starts at home and in the community. And so we're going to need parents and community members to partner with us to help us to get on top of these issues, because suspension is not the answer. You're exactly right with that. Suspensions is not the answer.
877-962-9862, the number to call to join our conversation. Charles is on the line from Hillsborough. Hello, Charles.
Hi, Frank. Listen, I'd like to broaden this conversation a little bit. I'm convinced that one of the reasons for the increase in suspension rates, at least in the county which I'm in, which is Orange County, my daughter's in the Orange County school system, is a kind of one-size-fits-all mentality. My daughter is a straight-A student. She's in the top five in her class, in a class of about 315 students. She was suspended for a week late in the year because she defended another girl. She felt that her best friend was in a situation where she was going to be attacked by somebody they knew, so she grabbed the other girl's arms. And for doing that, the principal told us that he had no choice but to give her a mandatory five-day suspension. The police were called and showed up. We had to go down to juvenile justice center. We had to go through counseling, all because my daughter did something which I really think is admirable, and that is that she interceded on behalf of her friend.
Well, Marvin Pittman, what about that? Do you want to respond to that? How are schools flexible enough? Do they have the flexibility that they need to really respond to these things?
It's difficult for me to weigh in on that particular situation since I don't have all of the facts. Again, it goes back to local board policy, and perhaps in that system they do have a policy that says for these kinds of behaviors, if it is determined that the child has broken these particular rules or regulations, that suspension is an option. I don't know that to be the case, but perhaps that's the case. One of the things that I would suggest is that, you know, parents continue to have dialogue with the schools, with the principals, and with superintendents. If they believe that their policies are so rigid that it doesn't give the child an opportunity to really make one small mistake, then there's a time for a conversation with administration in that district.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call, Charles. 877-962-9862. There's a broader question implied, though, in Charles' question, and that is this business of one size fits all. If we're suspending this number of students, it suggests to you that maybe the school itself hasn't figured out how to include enough students.
Okay.
Let me put the question to Sharia.
Well, actually, you had it right, Sharia. Marvin just likes to call me Sharia, and I allow him to get away with it.
That's all because we're friends.
Yes, exactly.
Sorry, Sharia.
I think that, you know, one of the biggest problems to me is that the state doesn't have any kind of really comprehensive statewide discipline policy. I think we've moved to the time where we need to do that. And I understand the business about local control, but I also would remind Marvin, as he knows one of my favorite topics is the Leandro lawsuit, that said that the state is ultimately responsible for ensuring that every child has access to a sound basic education. Now, if a child is suspended from school, clearly that child is not getting a sound basic education at that time. So I think that it behooves the state to start stepping in and at least working towards developing a comprehensive policy. It doesn't mean there's no local input and no local control, but too many school systems have very I can't think of a better term than nitpicking rules and regulations about what a child may or may not do, things that most adults can't even adhere to, and they come up with it. I mean, I've had horror stories of people telling me their children were suspended from school because they went down the wrong hallway, and when someone called them on it, they claimed that they didn't really do it, and so we suspend the child. Well, of course, lying is not good and not following rules is not good, but is this an offense for suspending the child or an offense for saying, okay, you're going to have to, you know, do like the old days, write 300 times, I will not violate right. The rules or whatever, but something that keeps the child in school rather than sending them home for an offense that isn't violent.
Well, and the more rules you have, it seems to me, the more open these rules are to subjective interpretation. And it gets us to the question of the racial disparity in these numbers, the fact that African-American students are four times more likely, and I'm going to check that number again, I think it's even higher, to be suspended. What's going on there, Sherry?
Well, I think that the connection is pretty direct to academic achievement issues. I believe that you know, typically when we, with the school system, minority students are performing at less of an academic level. I don't think this is because of any inherent lack of ability, but rather because of a lot of things that have to do with the structure of school and perhaps some type of racial, at least blindness to differences in culture. Because also Native American students seem to be impacted by the achievement gap, as well as Latino students, as our really growing population. So there is a connection between students who don't perform well academically and the kind of disconnect they feel that leads them to become troublemakers in the school. And then that coupled with the climate of schools where there's really no room for individuality in schools. There's a kind of conformity. I mean, when I hear about schools coming up with dress code issues that say one school system's Johnson County a few years ago, their rule was that children could not have hair color that wasn't found in nature. Now, they made a mistake in the way they phrased it because it's kind of like, well, excuse me, but all colors are found in nature. What they meant was you couldn't have orange or purple hair. And I thought, who cares? If the kids want to have hair that's got green stripes, let them have it. It's not going to interfere with their ability to learn. And when they get to be 30, they will not have hair with green stripes. I mean, you know, we all grow out of that stuff.
Oh, it'll stick that way. Let's go to the phone. Stephen is on the line from Durham. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
You have a question for us or a comment?
A comment. I want to say that I think there are some kids that just don't belong in school. I think that, you know, society at this point is dysfunctional enough that there are kids who are just too damaged to have being in school be a priority to them. And I think if it's not a priority for students to be in school, then they're not going to try to control the behaviors which cause them to be kicked out of school. My other point is for those who could make it in school, you know, they've decreased the vocational programs because it doesn't fit into the testing worldview. And, you know, if you have kids who are on the edge or trying to hold their behaviors together or try to, you know, make it academically, you know, the way to get them to stay in school is to give them something concrete. You stay in school, you're going to earn $10 an hour, you know, laying bricks or working on cars. And that speaks to a lot of kids who can't, you know, accept the abstract that it's good to get a high school diploma.
All right.
The other fact I want to bring in is the testing. And tell me, why should a kid stay in school if they have repeatedly failed the gateway exams and they're 16 in the ninth grade or 18 in high school and still trying to make it through algebra, which they have to pass? You know, I don't think many of us with advanced degrees would put ourselves through that year after year after year and allow ourselves to get beaten down.
Right. Marvin Pittman?
Let me weigh in on that one. One of the things that we cannot do is eliminate children from the educational process because we believe that they can't learn. Now, there may be a small number of students who would benefit from an alternative setting, but to just blanketly say that when children aren't doing well and they have not passed courses and they are older than they should be for this particular grade level, that we need to just kind of eliminate them from the public schools, that would be a fatal mistake. The Board of Education, the State Board of Education, is critically aware that we have to improve achievement for our students because there is a direct correlation between how well a child does academically and their behavior. And so to try to address one without doing the other would be a mistake. And so at the state level, we have focused on this issue of the achievement gap for a number of years, even before No Child Left Behind. And we've tried to make this a public conversation. We have worked directly with the schools because we know you've got to improve achievement if you expect behavior to improve. And also we know that behavior impacts academic performance. So So the two things go together, and that's why I said earlier, it is a comprehensive issue, and it's going to take lots of people working to helping us to improve.
Yeah, but help us see the vision. Where do you go if you bring in all these people, you understand that families are involved, the community's involved? Does that mean, schools, it sounds to me like, would have to radically restructure in order to become the kind of comprehensive entity that's going to manage these problems, if not solve the problems that you're talking about?
It's going to take a different way of doing business. When we formed the Raising Achievement and Closing Gaps Commission back in 2000, and they came out with their recommendations, one of the things that they talked about, several things they talked about, and one was improving parent involvement. We have to look at parent involvement through different lenses, not through traditional lenses. You got to involve the faith community. The State Board of Education has been concerned about the dropout rate, and so we put together a task force to look at what could we do to address the dropout rate. And tied to that, Frank, was the issue of suspensions and academic achievement. So it's going to take all of us working. It's going to take the schools embracing students who typically have not been embraced before. It's going to take parents being involved in different ways. Perhaps they've not been involved before, but it can't be left entirely to the schools.
Sherry, it sounds like, too, and you've talked about this before, what happens at the very earliest stages in early childhood development. Are we addressing that well enough?
Well, I do have a kind of pet theory that I've been working on for years, based on my own experience as a teaching assistant in kindergarten classes, that students come to school with such differing abilities and differing background preparations, and that the current way schools are structured, they really only play to the strengths of students who've come from a relatively structured preschool experience, daycare experience, who are familiar with all the ins and outs of how one behaves in a classroom. And the kids who come in from a different kind of environment, kids who've been cared well for, like with by relatives and community members, but they haven't had a structured environment.
Like so a daycare. They haven't been in daycare.
They haven't been to daycare. Yeah. Or if it is called a daycare, it really is just a woman who keeps kids in her home rather than a daycare that's got learning centers and the same equipment that you find in schools. So when they come into a kindergarten classroom that first year, and there's all of this stuff, and I don't think people know how much stuff is in there. There's water tables and sand tables and blocks and paints and just wonderful things. But if you're 5 years old and all of this stuff is in there, and the teacher says, well, you spend 15 minutes here, 15 minutes there, now it's time to sit on the rug and listen as we talk about Mr. B, because we're learning that letter that day, you still want to get over there to the sand table and the water table and the paints, and you're five, so you're going to do it, and you're going to have to be called back to the rug, and you're a discipline problem just because you're acting like a typical five-year-old.
It could go from there. Yeah, let's go to the phones. Christina is on the line from Durham. Hi, Christina.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. Back in the early 90s, I actually came from Hawaii, school system in Hawaii, to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg system. And I was just really shocked about, the difference between the two systems. It seemed like you lacked a whole lot of freedom and, just the ability to be a kid, to be a teenager. It felt like the school was almost like a prison. There was a lot of people running around and trying to keep everybody, inside the rooms, and you couldn't be walking out in the halls. Suspension, it just seemed like, was used to get rid of the problem instead of addressing the problem. I saw a lot of that going on.
All right. Well, how much of that, Marvin Pittman, just has to do with the changing times and, I guess, life in the post-Columbine world?
Responding to the caller's concern that things seem too structured,
yeah.
Is that what we're dealing
yeah.
with? Yeah. You got to have, obviously, some sense of structure. At the same time, though, I'm going to have to agree some with the caller. At the same time, you got to allow children to be children, and so it's going to have to be a healthy balance between the two. But you cannot have a school, though, that doesn't have structure, and that's one of the things I believe that has gotten us into trouble in our public schools, is that we lost some of the structure that we know works. from schools of the past.
And what are some of those structures? What are some of the ways you can do it short of the more draconian measures that we now see in place?
You know, I mentioned earlier, Frank, that suspensions as a whole are not the answers to improving behavior. You have to work with students early on. You have to intervene early. When young children start school, many children have not been to the traditional daycare centers. And so they come to school not knowing what behaviors are acceptable in a public schoolroom. So we as educators, we really have to teach the child just basic behaviors.
Does that mean putting on more counselors, having better student-teacher ratios?
That could be. However, it doesn't. You don't have to increase the workforce to do that. The teachers and the teacher assistants who are there now just need to be able to teach the children basic behavior. You know, if a child can't read, we teach the child how to read. If a child can't do mathematics, we teach the child these skills. Some children just don't know how to behave in a school setting. So we have to teach that, not get frustrated with the child, but teach it. So the teacher has to do it, the principal has to do it, but also the parents have to do it.
We're talking about discipline in North Carolina public schools this hour, talking with Sharia Reed, Director of the Education and Law Project at the North Carolina Justice Center, and Marvin Pittman, Director of Middle School Education at the North Carolina Department of Public Instructions. We'll talk a little bit about an alternative program in Wake County and take more of your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Are schools effective at handling discipline? If not, what can be done? It's the topic on The State of Things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour about discipline in North Carolina public schools, joined by Sharia Reed, Director of the Education and Law Project at the North Carolina Justice Center. Marvin Pittman is Director of Middle School Education at the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. And we're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. We've talked a lot about the home lives of students, and those lives can be difficult. And when you're in trouble in school, chances are you may be having trouble at home. And there are programs designed to help students who are having those problems. Haven House is one of them. Haven House is in Wake County and provides assistance to young people aged 10 to 18 and their families before, during, and after times of crisis. The executive director is Mike Reeder, and he joins us on the line now. Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
Do you see a lot of kids come through your program who have been suspended?
Oh, yes. Yes, I would say probably at least half of the youngsters that we deal with in a year have had one or multiple suspensions.
Now, I would guess that suspension is a good symptom of a problem. How do you think it is? How does it work as a cure?
Well, it doesn't work as a cure, but it is an opportunity to for the community to recognize that this young person is having difficulty that is making him or her unable to deal successfully with their responsibilities at school. And as you implied, it often carries over, originates in the home and elsewhere in the community.
What are some of the strategies that you use?
Well, the first is to look upon these events as opportunities. The second is, and I think it's the key strategy, is we have to engage the family. The schools, it's been mentioned several times on the show so far this afternoon, want to engage the family, but they are, given their scope and size, they're at a disadvantage to do that. Our agency is able to do that in a fairly intense way in our various programs. So I think that's key and essential. But also, I think by definition, we're often dealing with families whose parents themselves have not had positive experiences mm-hmm. with the school system, so they're very reluctant or unable to do that.
Well, what do you do in that case?
Well, first thing is you have to gain their trust, which means that you have to respond to them in a sensitive, accessible way. You have to have them to identify and experience small successes. It might, you know, this is behavior shaping, if you will, but they've got to experience success so that they have some confidence in what's to come. Third thing is you don't want to blame them. I've never met a parent yet who said, gee, I want to be a lousy parent. I think they're doing the best they can. And then the individual interventions would vary from family to family. Some families obviously require a lot more than others.
Marvin Pittman, mm-hmm. do you see this kind of programs like Mike Reeder's, and I'm sure there are others, at Haven House and other programs. Is that part of the solution, in a sense? Let's pull the kid out of school, get him out of this environment for a while, but have, programs where we can work with the kid and then get him back into the school system.
That's exactly the way suspension ought to operate. When a child is suspended, they ought not be walking the streets. They should be engaged in some meaningful activity. And I really want to thank Mike for his work that he does at Haven House, because that's where we're going to really make a difference. There are several programs across the state that do that kind of thing. We have several pilot sites going on now for long-term suspended students. For those students who have been long-term suspended, they are engaged in community service efforts in various communities across the state, which prevents the child from roaming the streets with nothing to do. Now, of course, some people don't support that kind of idea because they feel like if the child did something wrong, they just need to be out totally. And that's not healthy. One of the things, if I could jump in quickly and say this, I spent many years as a principal. And oftentimes when students were suspended, were referred to the office, teachers wanted me as the principal to suspend that student. And many times I didn't. Many times we would refer the child for some sort of counseling, have a conversation with parents, and then begin to work with the teacher on how to better understand this particular child. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with that, and I'm hoping that educators are really listening to this, the problem with that is that many times the teachers would say, well, you are not supportive mm-hmm. of us because we sent this child to you for disrupting class, he should have been suspended, and you didn't do that. I think sometimes as educators we are pressured to put these students out of school when perhaps that is not the best thing for the child. Perhaps what we need to do as administrators is to help our teachers to understand how we can work a little bit better with certain students. So, I will continue to say this is a comprehensive problem, Frank. It's not going to be easily solved. And I just really think that Haven House is doing that's the kind of program that we need to see across the
state. Well, but Mike Reeder, how do you find kids? I mean, are they referred to you, and what percentage of the kids who you think need help do you actually see?
Well, yes, many of the kids we receive are referred to us by school counselors, mental health counselors, court counselors. But in our crisis shelter, for example, one of our programs, a good number of those clients, either kids who have run away from home or in some form of crisis, come into the attention of law enforcement or brought into that way. This last fiscal year we just finished, we served about 1,200 youth and families, and Wake County had 17,000 short-term suspensions, so we surely didn't to reach them all.
Sherry, go ahead. Were you going to say something else?
Just want to let Marvin know. Marvin, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Council in Wake County just funded us to establish a program for short-term suspended students here in Wake County. You'll be glad to hear.
Great, great. Happy to hear that.
Put them on the list. Sherry, is there an effort at the legislative level to kind of mandate these sort of relationships and have the money follow?
Actually, last session, Representative Gene Preston had a series of bills. There were six bills all dealing with school suspension. And one of them in particular dealt with the issue that Marvin brought up about teachers and helping teachers get the kind of training that they need. Unfortunately, our largest teacher organization, NCAE, was vehemently opposed to being dictated to, which is what they felt that it was saying, because one of the things the bill called for was for all teachers to get certain types of continuing education credits for dealing with behavioral problems, multicultural sensitivity training, litany of types of training that might help them be more effective with dealing with the various behavioral issues of different students from different backgrounds. Unfortunately, there was a resentment, and I understand some of it. I was a classroom teacher. I do get it. But at the same time, I think Marvin was so right. I must admit, I witnessed myself colleagues who were insistent that the principal was being very unsupportive because he or she wouldn't suspend students that were sent to the office.
Well, I'm guessing, and Marvin, tell me if I'm correct, if you had a constructive program that, and you knew that this kid was going to get into something, you know, like Haven House or someplace else, you might be more willing to say, all right, let's give the teacher a break and those kids, because they're going to go someplace and not head out, hang out at the mall.
Right, and of course that would be one of our last options, because you really want to keep the child in school, so you would try to intervene as much as you could at the school level before you even thought about suspension, even for a program like Haven House. You got to try initially to keep the child in school. And many times we know what's driving many of these children out of school, and it's the relationships that they do not have with significant adults. And one of the things that we are really pushing at the state level is this thing called rigor, relevance, and relationships. You got to build relationships with students, one for academic performance and for behavior.
But do you have the time to do that, especially with state mandates on you know, standardized testing and all that?
You know, you've heard the old expression, you pay me now or you pay me later. If you don't have time to build relationships with students, you're going to pay a heavy price for that. And it doesn't, I'm not saying take the child out to lunch or take them to the movies. I'm just saying let the child know that you care about him. You know, a child needs to feel like they can come to you as their teacher or as their principal. Those are the kind of relationships I'm talking about. That doesn't cost money.
Let's go to the phones. Lynn is on the line from Greenville. Lynn?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is that I am a child psychiatrist in training, and I'm also a parent of two kids ages 9 and 12, or 9 and 16, and so I'm seeing this from both sides as a physician who is treating a lot of the behavioral problem kids, as well as what my kids are going through. And one of the things that I've noticed, in part because I have a family background of teaching, my mother was a teacher for 40 years, is that in the past we've had parents who had a strong sense of control of their children, usually with corporal punishment. But as we've gotten rid of corporal punishment and other changes in the society, we've also seen a decrease in their understanding of how to manage their own children's behavior without corporal punishment. And when that goes into the classroom and you have especially young teachers who also don't have skills in both child development understanding as well as in behavior management, we end up with the mess we've got now. And I'm convinced that one of the things we're going to have to do, and it sounds almost impossible, but to build the sense of community that Mr. Pittman was just talking about, we're going to have to probably look at smaller schools or at least smaller school divisions, but also start with the very earliest children in the schools as well as their parents, building parenting classes and child behavior management classes between parents and teachers so that everybody knows what to expect, and continue teaching children behavior management all the way up from kindergarten all the way through their senior year so that they learn parenting skills as a behavior management technique so that they understand how they should be parenting as well, because that's the only way in the long run we're going to be able to control it.
Frank, yep. Can I respond to that?
Yeah, Mike Reeder.
Mike Reeder, yes. Yeah. One of my observations in my earlier career, I was the PTA president, and you know, when we did parenting programs, the parents who most likely were to come to one of those parenting programs are the ones who students were most successful. So I think I agree with the caller just said, but it is a major challenge. The time we've been most successful in getting parents to participate in parent education programs were parents of fifth graders, because they were very anxious about their baby going off to middle school with all these big rascals. So they would come. So I think while I agree with the caller, I think it's a major challenge to market this to parents, because as the kids grow older, parents become less engaged in their educational experience.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Marvin.
When I meet with parents across the state, and in particular in churches, I would typically make two examples. One example is that the child who parents call their behavior cute. When a little child is somewhat sassy and to adults, and we call it cute. Many times little boys, when their behavior is out of control, we will say, he's all boy. Well, being all boy and being cute may be okay when the child is at home, but when the child comes to the schoolhouse where there are 25 other students, no longer is that behavior cute, or is it just being all boy? So we need to start early teaching children what is acceptable, when and where.
Well, I'm going to put a question along these lines to Mike Reeder. And Lynn, thank you for your call. Mike, you know, when you talk about starting early and you hear some of the comprehensive approaches we've talked about, you see kids when they're in there and they're having trouble. And how do you pull it together? And if you had, you know, how do you envision the program working, your relationship with the schools and the teachers? If you could map it out, money wasn't an object, what would it look like?
Well, I think the first systemic issue we have, and Marvin was saying this, I think we have to look upon these young people as a responsibility of the entire community. And what we've done systemically, I think, is put all that responsibility on the schools, and the schools have said, okay, we'll do this, give me some money, we'll do a grant. So when the kids are not able to be managed in a public school setting, then they're out with nothing there. So I think that's an important issue. But beyond that, I think it calls for very focused and structured involvement both with the school and with the family. And our various programs, we have seven different programs, and in all of those programs, that's the model we follow. And because we help the family identify the deficiencies that they have in their structure, in their parenting and so forth, and give them very specific skills to improve those, what we've been able to document over the years, probably what we're best able to document out of all the outcomes of our programs, have been improved academic behavior and lessening in terms of suspensions and behavioral problems in the school. It works if you have the structure, the specific skills, and you engage in a very structured way, the school teachers and the family.
And Sherry, I would guess you have to start young. Is there enough out there, especially for poor families, to get started and get started right?
Well, I think that, quite frankly, that even though I agree that parental involvement is significant, I also think from a purely pragmatic point of view that there are a lot of parents who've had negative experiences with schools who do have other issues on their minds, like paying bills and you know, the basic necessities of life, that unfortunately that it may just be a pie-in-the-sky dream that we're going to have all parents that involved in the schools, and that I do think it's up to the schools. And it is a severe burden, but I do think it's possible that there needs to be a focus on what teachers and administrators do in the school. So much of what's going on with the suspension rate and the discipline issues has to do, I do believe, with too many rules, first of all. I agree that there have to be rules, but rather than ramble, let me give you a concrete example. When I was a teacher, one of our principals came up with the notion that no males could wear hats in school. Now, this seems like a minor deal, but to the kids it was a big deal because they were all into their baseball caps and things that express their personality. So when you do that kind of stuff, all you do is set up an unnecessary barrier because it's going to get broken. Kids are going to violate the rule. They're going to get suspended. They're going to get into trouble. And the reality is you have to ask yourself, does this interfere with a student's learning because he or she has a hat on? And my answer is it does not. So why do you bother to make that rule when there are important rules that you want them to do, like bring your books to class, be on time for class, because that does have to do with learning. And when you fight the small battles all the time, all you do is alienate the students. And kids ask, as all of us did when we were under the age of 18, why do I have to do that? And you better have a good answer or they're not going to do it.
Thanks very much. Sherry Reed of the North Carolina Justice and Community Development Center, thank you. Marvin Pittman, Director of Middle School Education at the Department for Public Instruction, thank you. And Mike Reeder, Executive Director of Haven House, I want to thank all of you for being on our program today on the state of things, and thank you for listening. If you have a comment, send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Frank Stachow.